session number 4438, reel 3.
Mrs. Davis, reel 3.
As the result of the Edinburgh Tribunal in the middle of May 1940, I was apparently reclassified and was put into Category A, which I believe was reserved for people with Nazi sympathies. And that was, in my view, a profound mistake. But neither I myself was told of this, nor was Dr. Melville informed of this. And it took, in fact, quite a few months after I'd arrived on the Isle of Man before it was told to Dr. Melville that because of my reclassification as an enemy alien, I could not be released from internment along with refugee students. The vice-chancellors and principals of the Scottish and English universities between them had got the Home Office to agree that genuine refugee students, were to be released in time for the beginning of the next academic year. And of course, for a long time, I hoped and assumed, and nothing else entered my head, that I would be among them. And so did my friend Dr. Melville, of course. And it was only after this period was over and I was not among them that she apparently realized, perhaps she was told, I don't know exactly what form it took, but she realized that I had been reclassified and that it wasn't a mere formality, my release, and it had to be fought over. And from then onwards, Dr. Melville worked ceaselessly for my release until eventually, but I'm afraid not until a year later, I was released from the Isle of Man.
I'm really amazed that that judge would have classified you A. I wonder if it was a personality problem on his part or something.
I think in some ways, as I said to you, I realize now, although I failed to realize it really at the time, I realize now that I was in a very difficult position with my parents in Germany and not any contact with an official refugee organization. And my total lack of appreciation that the second tribunal really presented a rather serious moment in my life, and that I should have asked Dr. Melville or Hahn from Gordonston to come and speak for me. But I was out of touch with refugee affairs and really was quite unprepared for the... I had barely heard of internments here in London, and I had not heard of the Isle of Man as an internment camp at the time. And it was my own fault in that sense. And perhaps I failed not only to produce people of some standing whom the judge felt he could trust, I must have failed to defend myself, really, or to set out in a positive way to convince him of the genuineness of my case. I was so utterly stunned and taken aback by this air of suspicion with which questions were put to me. I had the feeling all the time they were trying to see if I was speaking the truth. I was asked things which seemed quite irrelevant to my case, as I think I've
told you.
What
sort of things did the judge say?
Well, I remember particularly that I was suddenly asked what were the names of the housemistresses of the houses where my two sisters lived at St. Leonard's. Things of that sort. I had the feeling that in the end the judge really didn't know what to make of me. I had the feeling in despair towards the end of my interview with him. He said to me, and this I remember very clearly, "Don't you realize that one word from Dr. Melville would have put the case right for you. And why hadn't I asked her to come? But I'm afraid I can only say that I hadn't realized it. And I thought my friends, the farmers with whom I worked and lived and had become very great friends by this time, and the warden of the hall, I had thought were capable of providing the information about me personally that was required, that I led a decent, normal, unsuspicious life. Nothing else had occurred to me. I was really totally unprepared for the second tribunal, that is all I can say.
Was the judge hostile, or was he just confused?
Hostile is perhaps almost too much, but he certainly was very suspicious of everything I said. I remember he asked me what money I lived on, and I quoted the figure, 5 shillings at the time per week, which I was given as pocket money by Dr. Melville and her friends, and he said, "You can't live on this," which of course he was quite right to say, but I lived without paying a penny with this Scottish family, the Taylors in Glasgow, and I didn't explain it to him. I assumed he knew this, though what reasons I had for thinking so, that was my stupidity, I suppose. I really failed to grasp that something quite different was expected of me, that I had to defend myself in some way, or put the case straight for him in some positive way. I was shocked and stunned, almost into silence, by his, I won't say perhaps hostile, although I think perhaps it bordered on this, by his suspicious attitude to me. I remember when he said, "You can't live on this," I said, "My father would send me money, but he can't, of course." I had the feeling my father was under some suspicion for not supporting his children as he ought to in this country. It didn't occur to me that he didn't think of my father, but of some illegal ways of obtaining money, I suppose, or that I had, I don't know, Nazi contacts, which I certainly didn't have.
I wonder if you, being so unprepared and, as you said, almost shocked to silence, seemed arrogant to him, almost as if you were refusing to answer his questions, possibly.
It could be, although I think he must have seen that I was near fainting. Towards the end, I remember at the end I was made to get up and I could hardly stand, and one of the warders had to come and help me out of the room. I was in a near state of collapse, really, I think, at the end of this. Really, he did say I would be interned. That is how it finished off the interview. But really, by his attitude, rather than by the fact of internment, that hadn't really sunk in.
I think you mentioned that you found out later, of course, that there was a possibility you might have been denounced.
Yes, I was told this by both Dr. Melville and my farmer's friends, and whether they were told this officially or by implication, I really don't know. But I was told years later, after I got out of the Isle of Man, I was told a year later that somebody is supposed to have denounced me and reported me to the police, the postmistress in the village nearest to the farm, that I was going for long walks along railways and picked up papers along the railway. Well, I have no recollection of doing anything of the sort, though I did go for walks sometimes, of course, either with the children of the farmer's family or alone sometimes. I was very fond of walking, and it's been my hobby all my life. And I had a great deal of energy in those days left over from working in the fields or in the household, as I did in all my vacations. But really, I can hardly believe that all this would have happened merely on the strength of the gossip of some rather stupid and ignorant woman. I don't know.
No, though that may have helped put the suspicion into his mind.
It could be. The outrageous thing was really that my farmer's friends came under suspicion, and instead of speaking for me, the judge turned his suspicion onto them. And my farmer's friends were in a somewhat unusual position, because until the summer of 39, these farmer's friends, the man, Dr. Carlslow, had been a lecturer at Cambridge in agricultural economics, and had decided, it so happened shortly before the outbreak of war, that he would turn himself into a practical farmer. And he had left Cambridge with his young family and had bought a farm in Perthshire and spent the rest of his life as a practical farmer. And this must have struck the judge as so unusual, or what, that... In fact, I heard later from Dr. Melville that Dr. Carslow, my farmer's friend, was under suspicion as a result of what he said or turning up at this tribunal for me. Instead of supporting me, he was viewed with great suspicion himself, which was outrageous, but that is the form it took.
You told me that you were taken away immediately. On the spot.
Yes.
That's not the way it usually happened, though I suppose they just couldn't lock you up fast enough since they had classified you A. Did you try to postpone your internment so that you could complete your exams?
No, it didn't occur to me. I was told at the end of the tribunal I would be interned, and that was the end of my tribunal, and I was taken out of the room to say goodbye to my friends. And the warden of the hostel who had come to speak for me, and I didn't put up any defense. I simply accepted it, and I was taken. I spent the next hour or two at a police station, I think, in Edinburgh. I have a feeling it was a police station. And from there, or it may have been the police at the court, I can't remember, and from there I was put on a train to go back to Glasgow alone, I was met on the railway platform in Glasgow towards the end of that day by a policewoman who took me to the women's prison in Glasgow that evening.
You could, of course, have got off the train before you got to Glasgow.
It did occur to me as I sat there, and then I must say it did occur to me, not to run away, but I thought I would end my life. And then I didn't. And I thought I would face what was coming. And I met this woman met me, and she took me to the women's prison in Glasgow. And I was admitted like any ordinary prisoner, I think I told you. And rather, I think the prison episode was rather unnecessary. I took it rather badly, I'm afraid. Particularly because I found myself alone in prison. There were a few Italian women who'd been imprisoned. I didn't know them, of course, but there was an Italian woman in the cell next to me who was crying from morning to night because she'd been separated from her family. And I didn't meet anybody else until a few days after I had arrived in prison, when these political refugees, left-wing political refugees from Germany who had arrived from Norway, turned up at the prison, and I became very friendly with one woman in particular, and she also was sent to, they were sent to the Isle of Man later, and I was very friendly with her until she was released. I believe they returned to Germany after the war. They were social democrats, nothing to do with Jewish refugees in that sense. But I was alone in prison, and even when I got to the Isle of Man, I didn't know anybody at first there, and I'm afraid. I took it badly. I was in a state of shock, really. Although I must say I never felt resentment at internment. I fully understood the politically how serious the situation was for Britain. I mean, as far as I was capable of understanding these things, I did understand it. And I thought that the authorities were fully justified in taking these emergency measures, only I felt I oughtn't have been among the internees. I felt a mistake was made in my case.
It was, of course, just at the time of the fall of France.
Exactly. Exactly in those days, either day before or after the fall of France. And of course, it was a desperate situation.
How long were you in the prison in Glasgow?
I think, about a week. It may have been a week and 2 days, something of that order. And while one was there, one was treated like all the prisoners, of course. Exactly the same way, and I was exercising. Well, I won't bother you with details. I was allowed home to my Scottish family with whom I lived once from prison to pack my luggage because I understood I was to be sent for internment to Canada, but that must have been changed again, this plan. Because, in fact, the next thing I knew, I was on one of these transports to the Isle of Man.
And what happened about your last exam?
The last exam? I implored the prison authorities, the woman in charge of the prison, I've forgotten her name, I'm afraid she was not a very impressive woman, seemed not quite adequate for her job. I was surprised. I asked for an interview with her the day after I arrived in prison to implore her to send a message to the university that I was in fact prevented from presenting myself for the last practical exam at the university. I was so afraid that my not turning up would induce them to fail me, as I think was the rule, as if people turned up without an excuse. But it must have, and whether she did in fact make contact, I can't say. But all was well. I mean, I wasn't made to repeat the thing when I came back. I was able to go into my second year, and all was well.
Just for a bit about the prison, could you tell me about your reception at the prison?
Yes, I remember it very clearly. At the end of this day, after I'd been to the tribunal, and I was in a state of shock already, and this last little episode in the prison just about, I think I was near a state of collapse at the end. For the next few days in prison, I remember I could hardly eat and get up off my bed and so on. I was received into prison, not by any of the prison warders or the woman in charge of the prison, I forget what she was called, but by one of the inmates, one of the women who was, imprisoned for life. A little, quite old woman, I heard later that she's from one of the prisoners, that she is supposed to have murdered one of her children. She was put in charge of my case, and I had to strip before her and had to have her bath and her under her supervision, and she examined my clothing, that nothing was hidden. I don't know what she was looking for, but nothing was hidden there that she seemed to consider ought not to be there, and I had to record what money I had on me, I think. And she gave me a form to fill in, which I suppose all prisoners who were admitted to prison have to fill in, quite normal sort of name and date of birth and address and so on. And I remember her saying to me, if I didn't know how to write my name, to make three crosses on the bottom line. Then I don't think I saw any officials of the prison that night. I was shown to my cell. It is possible a warder showed me to the cell. I can't remember now. And the door was banged behind me. I'm afraid this terrible banging, metallic sound of these banging prison doors, I've never forgotten. That same night, the door was opened once more, and a Bible was thrown, more or less, onto a little triangular corner table by the door, and the door was banged again. And that, I'm afraid it strikes me as very funny now, but it didn't strike me as funny at the time. And that was the reception in prison, and one was then treated, I think, exactly like other prisoners. We had an hour's exercise in a very sad kind of desolate looking courtyard where prisoners were made to walk in a circle with so much distance between you and so on. And the hours of daytime were spent not entirely in the cell, but in some kind of workshop. I remember sitting in a sort of day room for prisoners, for women, and we were given sewing to do, of all things, stitching the caps the prison warders wore. That was our occupation. And I talked to the women there. It was rather interesting to see what, in a way, harmless and pathetic sort of women they were. Really, women who got there through some personal misfortune. One had the feeling it was either drugs or alcohol or some terrible social problems in their families. Nobody struck me as particularly vicious, but not at all. Rather, they were awfully friendly to one another and to me. Called you dear and tried to comfort you if you said you couldn't eat and rather jolly, in a way, very naive, rather jolly women who, I think, in a way, enjoyed the company of other women there.
They must have realized you were German, however.
I can't remember this entered into it. Of course they must. I mean, my English must have been still pretty dreadful. But I don't remember this being discussed. They very naive women, very low mentality, most of them. All of them, all the ones I met. And when the Norwegian political refugees arrived, who had got to Glasgow, I think I told you, on the ship that brought the Norwegian king to Scotland, it brought the last few of this batch of political refugees to England. And when these women arrived in prison a few days after I got there, I decided I wouldn't go to the sewing room anymore, but sit in a kind of sitting room and talk to these women. We weren't forced to work. One had apparently the option. The woman in charge of the prison took this very amiss and told me I was as bad as the others, that I from then onwards refused to work, as she thought, but I must say I preferred the company of these women, and I didn't then sit and do the stitching of prisoners' caps, prison warders' caps. I remember one was bundled off to the Sunday service. Amazing experience to know this. One was marched off to service, to church in prison on the Sunday, and made to sit in prison, with a sort of distance between individual women of 2 yards or so, every 2 yards a woman, and the prison warder sat with the back to the altar, facing us, keeping an eye on us. And all struck me as a very sad episode in my own life. Otherwise, it was quite interesting to see how these things worked. And in church, one saw the men prisoners. They were also there, though they sat in a separate part of this prison church. But one saw them. Otherwise, there was no contact with men, of course. And then quite soon I was, certainly it can't have been more than 9 days at the most, I think, that I was in prison. My Scottish, Mrs. Taylor, my friend with whom I lived, was allowed to visit me in prison.
What did she think of what had happened to you?
I think she was as shocked as in a way as I was. Although I must say, of course, she couldn't have appreciated all the ins and outs, really. I don't think she was politically so particularly well informed, just like any other woman of her land society, and no more and no less. She was very shocked that I was there, and I think she was profoundly sorry for me and tried to do everything she possibly could. And I appreciated very much that she came to visit me in prison, because it must have been a horrible experience for her, and beyond description. I don't think she had done that. I can't imagine that she did a great deal of social work in Glasgow, but voluntary social work, as women did. But I don't think she was quite fully prepared for the prison circumstances there.
You said that despite the fact you were really in a state of shock, they wouldn't even let you lie on your bed.
Yes, exactly. I remember the first few days I felt rather done in, as I suppose, by it all. I felt I couldn't eat and could hardly, really, hadn't much energy. And I remember spending some hours of the daytime lying on my couch, but I remember a prison warder coming in, bursting in on me and ticking me off for this, that it wasn't allowed, it was against the regulations. The mattress would be ruined if all the women did this, so one had to sit on one's chair. So I really can't see what difference it would have made.
It must have been quite a contrast then, going from prison to internment. Internment is a kind of prison, but it was hardly the same.
Not at all, not at all. It was totally different. And I think after the initial chaos that reigned on the Isle of Man when I got there, and before, because I think I was relatively late in arriving on the Isle of Man, I don't know when exactly this wholesale internment of refugees started here in London, but I think I must have been relatively late getting to the Isle of Man. Because there were so many women there already when I arrived, there was initially a complete chaos.